and from other market players in the fields of machinery and car production, particularly in the domain of electric vehicles. The problem is further compounded by interest rate hikes over the last 2 years, revealing setbacks in the German property market. According to data gathered by Bloomberg Television, in January, more than $13.6 billion in loans and bonds doled out by companies in the country were distressed, which is 13 times Italy's level. A report by Alvarez & Marsal, a consulting company, says that roughly 15% of firms in the recession-hit Germany are in trouble. Additionally, Germany is facing a budget crisis. Sources familiar with the budget calculations disclosed, despite Chancellor Olaf Scholz's coalition government managing to overcome the difficult challenge of passing this year's budget, there's still a 20 billion euro gaping hole in the budget expected in 2025. Germany's budget problems have caused a decline in approval ratings for Olaf Scholz's SPD, Habeck's Greens, and Lindner's FDP. The AfD now polls at 19% and shows no signs of losing ground, just trailing behind the Christian Democrats, the CDU, with 32%. The website of Euronews has also covered the same story. German industrial output extended its slump to a seventh month in December, underlining the struggles gripping Europe's largest economy. The Statistics Office said on Wednesday, 7th of February, production fell 1.6% from November, led by chemicals and construction sector. The drop was far worse than the 0.5% decline predicted by analysts in a Euronews survey. The overall level of production is now at its lowest level since June of 2020, and stripping out the shock of the pandemic, the last time it was so weak was way back in 2010. Germany is facing a potential recession after output shrank by 0.3% in the fourth quarter of 2023. And this year began on a shaky footing. The data underscore the difficulty in reviving the economy amid weak global demand, high interest rates, and the enduring consequences of the energy crisis. There was mixed news in recent days when figures showed an unexpected jump in December factory orders, albeit only thanks to major orders, alongside a continued slide in exports. The inflation and employment backdrop remains more positive. Consumer price growth slowed more than the expected in January to 3.1%, and a drop in joblessness underscored the labour market's surprising resilience. But the German Finance Minister Christian Lindner warned that Germany is suffering because of its failure to boost output. He told a Euronews event on Monday, 5th of February, in Frankfurt, Germany, he said, "We're no longer competitive. We are getting poorer because we have no growth. We're falling behind." China's Xinhua News Agency has also covered the same story. According to provisional figures published by the Federal Statistics Office, the Statis, recently German companies started 12.3% more insolvency procedures in December of 2023 compared to the same period in 2022. It was the seventh month in a row with double-digit year-on-year growth in the number of new insolvency procedures in Germany. According to the Statis, from January to October of 2023, corporate insolvencies were up 24.1% year-on-year. The German Hospital Federation warned at the end of last year the situation in hospitals is worse than ever before, expecting insolvencies to reach record levels in 2024. According to a survey by the German Hospital Institute, around 70% of the country's hospital operators fear that the economic situation in the country will deteriorate further this year. The retail sector has also been affected. Recently, Germany's largest department store chain, Galeria Karstadt Kaufhof, had to file for insolvency due to the collapse of its holding company, Signa Group. It was the third insolvency filing for the troubled store chain in less than 4 years. The catering industry in Germany is also anticipating a growth in insolvency proceedings. Since the beginning of 2024, the earlier value-added tax rate of 19% on restaurant meals has been reinstated after the government had reduced it to 7% during the COVID-19 pandemic. The German Hotel and Restaurant Association said at the end of last year, as a result, business closures and insolvencies will be inevitable from March of 2024. The Reuters news agency has also covered the same story and tells us more. According to preliminary figures published by the Federal Statistics Office, DStatis, on Monday, 5th of February, Germany's imports and exports both declined in 2023 amid recession. According to the figures, exports of Europe's largest economy were down 1.4% from 2022 to 1.56 trillion euros, while imports slumped 9.7% to 1.35 trillion euros. Carolyn Herweg, an expert at the Chamber of Commerce and Industry, said 2023 was a lost year for Germany's export industry. She said high inflation and high interest rates, as well as geopolitical risks, had reduced demand, which caused the drop in exports of goods. Dirk Yandura, president of the country's Wholesale Foreign Trade and Services Association, said, with exports to key markets stagnating or declining, last year's figures reflect the continued weakness of German foreign trade. The German Economic Institute assumes that the country's export model will remain in crisis this year as the geopolitical situation continues to be uncertain. The German Economic Institute said at the end of last year that after registering fewer foreign orders for 2 years, many German industrial companies were holding back on investments.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the pitch.
On Youth Station.
I am a Muslim. Allah my Lord. His word Quran. Muhammad Prophet. Praise be upon. I am Muslim for all of time.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners, dear brothers and sisters. This is Youth Station with IRIB English Radio, and I am one of your hosts, Mustafa, and with me today in the studio is...
Yeah, and I'm Beta, and it's a pleasure to be here.
You know, I've been married now for about 12 years.
Nice.
Okay? And I don't think I would have been married for 12 years if my wife wasn't such a forgiving person. In any relationship, right, you have to be forgiving. It's not just a one-way street, right? It's a two-way street, right? But it's really, really important, I think, in any relationship. I didn't realize the value of forgiving others or being forgiven probably the way I realized it during marriage and having kids. Because kids, all the time, you have to forgive them. Because, you know, they're always doing something crazy or they're doing something that you don't want. And then you have to be forgiving, right?
You know, I'm one of the people that can get easily mad at other people, unfortunately. I'm really trying to be moderate, to be patient, to be this and that, but it's a bit difficult in some situations to keep your temper and to be patient when some other people are judging you in a bad way or are telling you something that they don't have the deep knowledge of that thing. And in those situations, I would be really angry. I would act as sometimes sometimes it happens with my beloved ones. For example, with my family, with my sister specifically. And at those times, I'm really happy that I have a forgiving family that always forgive me in these kind of situations, and they would understand me that sometimes I get angry. I don't have any kind of serious intention of spouting those words at the at my beloved people. And the thing is, being forgiving and being forgiven sometimes at both situations are some blessings that we can go through in our life.
Right.
So first, let's start with being forgiving towards the people when they make a mistake. Are you a patient one?
I don't think I can answer that question that well. But what I would say is that, you know, forgiveness is one of God's attributes, right? It's one of his 99 names, that he is Ghafoor, that he is the forgiver. And I try to get my inspiration from that, you know, that as much as God has been forgiving to me in my life and all the mistakes that I've made, and he's still been there for me, you know, he's still been loving. So in the same way, God says you should, you know, we have narration, he says that you should be that way. You should be forgiving like God.
Yeah.
If you forgive others, then God will forgive you.
Yeah.
Right? And of course, we have so many examples where the prophets or the imams, they forgave their enemies. Right? I think one of the best examples that I like is of Hazrat Hur in Karbala.
Exactly.
You know, he was the guy who stopped Imam Hussein's horse, you know, from moving forward, you know. He grabbed the reins of the horse.
Yeah.
Right? But later on, when he came to ask forgiveness for that, the Imam forgave him. Right? Our Imams can be so forgiving towards their own enemies or people who have wronged them so much. Why can't I be that way? You know, why can't I be forgiving towards others as well, right? It's not easy, obviously. It's very difficult to do that. But if you do it, you'll feel much better on the inside.
Yeah.
Right? Have you been in any situation where you've had to, like, forgive someone?
Yes, I was,
for something
for sure.
Extreme, maybe?
I believe no one is perfect. Every individual on this earth has some, for example, deficiencies, has some weaknesses, and the weakness may reveal itself in communication with other people. So sometimes other people will make mistakes, and this is completely natural. Okay, the thing that will make me really upset about other people is that when they make mistakes and they know they are making mistakes, but they don't accept that they are the one that is making mistakes, and they don't go for apology. And these are the situations that forgiveness is becoming really difficult for me.
Yes.
Even at the times that they are regretful about their past behavior, even at those times, still it's a bit difficult for me to be forgiving towards these people. But at least I try to have the seerah of my infallibles, peace be upon them, and also keep in mind that it was one of the biggest characteristics of Allah Almighty that he is merciful and forgiving. And whenever you are regretful about the things that you did in the past, whenever you feel that you have to go in the doors and in arm of Allah Almighty and ask his forgiveness, he's always there to accept you. And when I see this amount and this vastness of forgiving from my Creator, then there is no way other than being forgiving for me. It's time to go for a short break to get refreshed.
Okay. The topic that we've been discussing is forgiveness. And one thing that you said that kind of triggered a thought in my mind is that, you know, you were saying some people that don't accept responsibility and it becomes harder to forgive them. You know, I found that sometimes with those people, if you do forgive them, or if it's happened with me, right? Maybe I, especially with my dad, for example, he's a very forgiving person. When he would forgive me, I would feel even worse. if he would get angry with me, that wouldn't be as bad. But sometimes when he was so nice to me, when he was so forgiving to me after something bad that I'd done, it made me feel even worse about it, right?
I know this feeling.
So sometimes, like, even if someone doesn't accept the responsibility, but if you're, like, nice towards them, you cause them much more pain than coming angry with them.
I believe this behavior is way too nice and way too humane that will touch the heart of those people who are in mistake. And the thing is, up to here, we talked about this characteristic of being forgiving towards someone that make mistake. But another dimension to look at this topic is being the one who is actually forgiven.
We all love, like, you know, for our mistakes to not be looked at, right?
Maybe. No. But, you know, there are times there are some people who are so arrogant that when they make mistake and when they come to you in order to, for example, tell you that, okay, I made this mistake, and when you forgive them, they feel like, oh my God, how dare you, for example, look down at me to, for example, see yourself in a position to forgive me.
Okay, thankfully, I've never been in that situation, it's difficult for me to sort of relate to that.
Yeah.
But you mentioned, like, arrogance, right?
Exactly.
Arrogance is a big barrier towards not only forgiving others, but also seeking forgiveness. And, you know, the best example of that we have is in the Quran, is of Shaitan, right? Is of that he disobeyed God. Instead of, like, asking for forgiveness, what does he do? He becomes arrogant. He says, like, this was your mistake, by the way.
Exactly.
There's a story. There's this thing called the Gospel of Barnacle, I think, I can't remember the exact name.
Okay.
It's basically, Gospels are like parts of the Bible. It's not considered an official part of the Bible, but there's a really interesting story in that you know, Jesus, Hazrat Isa, he says to God, I want to have a meeting with, you know, with Satan, right?
Yeah.
And so they have a meeting, and Satan says, and Jesus says, you know, Hazrat Isa says to Satan, hey, you know, if you were to ask God for forgiveness, I've talked to him. If you ask for forgiveness, he will reinstate you in your position. He'll forgive all the bad things that you've done.
Yeah.
And you just need to ask for forgiveness. And you know what he says in reply? He says, you know, God should ask me for forgiveness because he's the one who made the mistake of making me bow down to Adam. Right? So arrogance is a huge sort of barrier, and it works both ways, in being forgiven and even asking for forgiveness.
For sure. So, brother, as you know, we talked about these two dimensions of forgiving and being forgiven. But the thing is, for asking forgiveness from someone, there are some specific ethics and morality. Specifically, when you want to ask forgiveness from Allah Almighty, there are some situations and there are some steps that you have to take. And for example, telling that, oh, Allah Almighty, I'm regretful, to forgive me is not enough. And let's talk about this process of asking forgiveness after a short break.
Okay. This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
So, welcome back, dear listeners. This is Usation. We were talking about the characteristic of being forgiven or forgiving other people. And we came to this point in this question that what are the criteria for asking forgiveness from Allah Almighty?
We've been given those criteria by the Prophet and the Imam. And, you know, I think one of the biggest criteria of, you know, being forgiven is not repeating that action again. Right? They say that, you know, that is one of the biggest criteria, that you don't do that action again, and that means you're pretty much forgiven, right?
Exactly.
That's like the sign of that. Another one is, for example, that, you know, you sort of have to make up for that, whatever mistake that you made, in the way, to the point that Imam Ali said that, let's say you were committing sins and you ask forgiveness, you know, the fat that's like gotten on your body, that fat needs to be melted away.
Exactly.
Right? So it's showing you the importance of bringing a very, very huge change in your life. It's not like, you know, I'm saying, oh, sorry, and then I go back and do that again.
Yeah.
Right? Then you're not really being sincere, right?
And I believe you mentioned some important hints, but I think the first step in order to ask forgiveness is to accept that you make the mistake.
Of course, yes.
When you have this level of acceptance to confess that you make a mistake because you're not a complete creature, that's the first step towards Allah Almighty in order to ask forgiveness. And another thing is that not doing that mistake again that you mentioned, but there are times that people feel because they're too get drowned in the ocean of mistakes and sins, they don't have the opportunity to ask forgiveness from Allah Almighty. They cut their hope from Allah Almighty. And this is one of the traps of Satan that will have for you in order to deviate you from the right path. And it will conceive you in a way that you feel like there is no time for you
right.
in order to compensate the mistakes that you've done up to here.
Definitely hope. You know, we've told that one of the worst things that, you know, a person can do, in fact, it's forbidden in our religion, is to lose hope in God.
Yeah.
Right? There's a verse of the Quran, I can't remember which chapter it's in, but it says, Ya ibadi allazeena asrafu, la taqnatu min rahmatillah, inna la yaghfiru dhunuba jamia. I once heard a lecture on this verse, and I would recommend our listeners to go and look at the sort of background behind this verse.
For sure.
You know, God is so loving in this verse. Like, even every word in it is loving. He says, you know, oh, my servant, you know, the one who's exceeded the limits, you know, I will forgive, you know, don't lose hope. I will forgive all of your sins. And we're told this verse was sent for someone who had done some pretty evil things with a dead body, okay?
Yeah.
I'm not going to repeat those things. To the point when he came and told the prophet, you know, that he had done this thing with the dead body, the prophet told him, you know, get away from me. Like, you know,
oh,
I'm worried
God.
That the punishment of God will come upon me while you're here.
Yeah.
And they say this person then went out, you know, into the desert, and he tied himself like to a rock or a tree for like 40 days. And then this verse came, you know.
I didn't know this.
The prophet said,
verse.
You know, go and
yeah.
open his chains and tell him that he's been forgiven. Like you said, is to not lose hope. And accept the responsibility and
exactly.
confess to God that, you know, you made that mistake.
But it doesn't mean that you can, for example, make use of the forgiveness of Allah Almighty. For example, there are some group of people, specifically youngsters, that they feel like, okay, I have a lot of time in order to ask forgiveness of Allah Almighty. Whenever I get old, I can, for example, go pray or this and that. And nowadays,
yeah.
I have to use my youth time in order to have fun. In order
right.
to do this and that.
Right.
It's not like that. One of the biggest and most beautiful thing in the scene of Allah Almighty is to ask His forgiveness in actually when you're young. And I think it's a blessing for us, for example, to know and to hear these beautiful things. And consider this episode of Youth Station as a trigger for you in order to go and ask forgiveness for all the sins, all the mistakes that you've done up to here.
And also be forgiving, more forgiving towards others.
Yeah.
You know,
we're
to develop,
all human.
To develop that ability or that quality in yourself. And that's all the time we have for today. Thank you so much for listening. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I will tell you, dear youth, that the future belongs to you. By Allah's favor, you, dear youth, will see that day, and you will hand down your sources of pride to the future generations. Greetings, be upon you and Allah's mercy and blessings.
And inshallah, we will continue talking about
this. We'll discuss that inshallah in the next session. Wassalamu alaikum.
Alhamdulillah, Rabbil Alameen. And don't go away.
We will continue this very essential topic with our great youth.
Wassalamu alaikum. Wassalamu alaikum. Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Latif. Ya Latif. Ya Latif. Ya Latif. Allah, 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 Allah.
In the limelight.
The Israeli occupation forces' deliberate targeting of journalists is still ongoing as the death toll of media personnel rises to 126. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote, journalists continue to be a target of the Zionist regime's ongoing assault on the Gaza Strip, with two more reporters killed recently. Two more Palestinian journalists have been killed in Israeli regime airstrikes in the besieged Gaza Strip, increasing the death toll to 126 since October 7th, according to the government media office. The two reporters have been identified as Ala Hassan Al-Hams and Anqam Ahmad Adwan of the local SND news agency and Libya's February channel, respectively. The government media office said the death toll of journalists increased to 126. They were killed in an Israeli regime bombardment in Rafah and Jabalia cities recently, without providing any further details by the media office. Last month, the office of the ICC's chief prosecutor Karim Khan confirmed to Reporters Without Borders, RSF, that crimes against journalists are included in its ongoing investigation into the situation in Palestine. This follows the two last complaints filed by the Paris-based RSF with the International Criminal Court, the first on October 31st and the second on December 22nd, which called on the prosecutor to investigate all Palestinian journalists killed by the Israeli regime army. RSF said that Khan's office stated for the first time that crimes against journalists were included in its investigation. The statement assured the RSF that crimes against journalists are being examined by the prosecutor's office, among other potential crimes, as part of the ongoing investigation into the situation in Palestine, and RSF's objectives and actions must be supported and are of crucial importance in Gaza and elsewhere. It added that journalists are protected by international humanitarian law and the Rome Statute and must not, under any circumstances, be targeted in the exercise of their important mission. According to Gaza's Ministry of Health, 28,340 Palestinians have been martyred and 67,984 wounded in the Zionist regime's ongoing genocide in Gaza starting on October 7th. Moreover, at least 8,000 people are unaccounted for, presumed dead under the rubble of their homes throughout the Gaza Strip. Palestinian and international organizations say the majority of those martyred or wounded are women and children. The Israeli regime aggression has also resulted in the forceful displacement of nearly 2 million people from all of the Gaza Strip, with the vast majority of the displaced forced into the densely crowded southern city of Rafah near the border with Egypt in what has become Palestine's largest mass exodus since 1948 Nakba. Meanwhile, Al-Mayadeen English reported the government media office in Gaza reported that the number of Palestinian journalists killed since the beginning of the genocidal war against Palestinians in Gaza has reached 126 with the recent killing of two female journalists. Ala Hassan Al-Hams, a journalist with SND agency and other media outlets, and Anqam Ahmad Adwan, a journalist from Libya's February channel, were both martyred due to the continuous Israeli regime bombardment and targeting of civilian homes in Rafah and Jabalia areas. Al-Hams succumbed to the injured she sustained in Israeli regime airstrikes on Rafah. In the previous month, an Israeli regime strike resulted in the killing of 11 members of her family, and she suffered a spinal fracture. During the recent airstrike, both she and her unborn child were martyred, along with the remaining members of her family. Al-Mayyad in English added, it is worth noting that the head of the Sana'a negotiating delegation and spokesperson for the Ansarullah movement, Muhammad Abdul Salam, expressed condolences for the martyrdom of journalist Al-Hams, stating, our condolences to the remaining family and relatives of the journalist Ala Al-Hams, who was murdered in Rafah City. He reiterated his condemnation and denunciation of the ongoing Israeli regime aggression on the Gaza Strip. Meanwhile, journalist Anram Adwan was residing in Libya and worked in several institutions and media channels. She had recently returned to the Gaza Strip and was murdered as a result of the airstrike carried out by Israeli regime occupation on her home. Although Palestinian and international media repeatedly warned against the Israeli regime army targeting media crews and called for their protection, the occupation never responded to those calls and continued to target journalists as part of its attempts to obscure the facts, hide the picture, and prevent the documentation of the massacres it continues to commit in its ongoing aggression. The government media office in Gaza reported that the Israeli occupation military is once again engaging in incitement to continue the assassination of Palestinian journalists and attempting to justify its crimes. In a press release, the office said the Israeli occupation military occasionally issues inciting publications against various media outlets and Palestinian journalists, attempting to market false narratives as a prelude to assassinating or killing them, as well as justifying its crimes and obscure the Palestinian narrative. It pointed out that this has been repeated dozens of times since the start of the genocidal war against Palestinians. According to the statement, the Israeli occupation publishes photos and videos of journalists and photographers as if condemning them, but it selectively extracts them from reports they have prepared and previously broadcasted on television channels and through social media as part of their daily field journalistic work, the office noted. We have issued previous statements and declarations clarifying that the occupation engages in incitement against various Palestinian sectors and employees in diverse fields. This includes incitement against the health sector, hospitals, doctors, and as well as mosques, schools, universities, and many other sectors, it added. The statement emphasized that the occupation's aim of this incitement is to try to justify its targeting of all Palestinian sectors and the killing of doctors, teachers, journalists, and others who have been explicitly targeted. The government media office in Gaza held the Israeli occupation fully responsible for the lives of the Palestinian people, warning the world against the occupation's targeting of journalists, doctors, teachers, civil defense personnel, and all the categories of Palestinian society. It also called on all free world countries to pressure the occupation to stop the genocidal war it is waging against civilians, children, women, and all the categories of the Palestinian society.
When the whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Thank you. Today's lesson, philosophy and ethics in our Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It is such an honor to be here at your service, dear friends, dear listeners. We are talking about philosophy and ethics when it comes to our Islamic lifestyle. Now, don't worry, we're not talking about the various different intricacies of philosophy or ethics. Now, I know many a times when we think about the term philosophy, or we think about the subject of philosophy, we are transported to our college days, and we kind of feel so lost when it comes to philosophy. Now, what are we talking about here when we're talking about Islamic lifestyle, and we're talking about philosophy and ethics? Well, don't be scared. It's actually quite simple. Now, when we're talking about philosophy, we're just using the term in order to refer to something which is called speculative wisdom. Now, in the Arabic, it is known as hikmatun nadhariya. Nadhariya meaning it comes from this kind of, well, I don't know if we want to call it speculative, but it is this kind of a science of wisdom, if you will. And really, that's what philosophy is. Philosophy, in very loose terms, is the science of wisdom. The whole purpose of philosophy in its core essence is to be able to allow us to attain higher levels of spiritual and metaphysical realities of the cosmos. And so, yes, that, I guess, is philosophy. So this kind of a reality of the existence of human being, of the existence of God, of the existence of time, these kind of realities is what is known as philosophy or speculative wisdom or hikmatun nadhariya. The other aspect, of course, is ethics, which is loosely translated as al-hikmatun amaliya. Amaliya meaning amal, it comes from action, and so that's why it's referred to as practical wisdom. Now that we know these two things, hopefully we're going to be able to understand what roles they play in our Islamic lifestyle. Welcome back. This is A2Z on IRIB English Radio. So we're talking about philosophy, speculative wisdom, hikmatun nadhariya, and we are talking about ethics or practical wisdom, also known as al-hikmatun amaliya. Now, it seems so confusing, even though we're trying to make it as simple as possible. Now, what do these two terms have to do with our Islamic lifestyle? We don't have to be a PhD student, and we don't have to be in a very simple, practical manner. When we're talking about philosophy, right, and we're talking about the different realities of existence, well, this is where we turn to the Holy Quran, and we turn, you know, to the different verses of the Holy Quran, the chapters of the Holy Quran, in which the various realities of life and death, of the hereafter, of ancient nations that have passed, you know, as well as historical context, stories, parables, all of these things we learn from the Holy Quran, and it is these things which teach us the realities of existence. So now we have covered our aspect of philosophy or speculative wisdom. But what's left, of course, is ethics or practical wisdom, or this, you know, the action part of this whole equation. So we've learned the various different conceptual realities from the Holy Quran. Well, now we turn to the seerah and the sunnah of the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, as well as the immaculate and infallible imams alayhi wasalam, the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam. And it is their practical actions, it is their virtuous codes of conduct, their behaviors, these virtues that they exemplify and manifest, as well as the evil habits which they have purged from themselves, and of course that they have been able to reach a level of being ma'asum, of being infallible or immaculate. So that is the practical wisdom and the practical aspect which we're talking about. Ethics is to live the life according to the role model put forth, which is the Messenger of Allah, sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. And there you go. It's as simple as that. Philosophy and ethics when it comes to our Islamic lifestyle.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
One of the most profound awakenings for Westerners since the launch of the Palestinian resistance operation Al-Aqsa Storm has been their understanding of how influential the Zionist lobby is. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Press TV noted, the Zionist lobby, which works in line with the U.S. State Department when it can and independently and subversively when it cannot, tends to influence major arenas of societal interest. On the surface level, one can simply follow the money and understand the phenomenon. The Israeli lobby pouring millions of dollars into buying U.S. politicians. Zionist hate groups unleashed to stifle pro-Palestinian students on college campuses. Celebrities and artists flown out to Israel to pose with Israeli occupation soldiers in order to paint them in a positive light. However, more devious and subversive groups exist within American society, specifically designed to normalize the concept of not only an Israeli regime, but the imperialist settler ideology of Zionism. These organizations are designed with the American left in mind. Using left-wing, pro-worker sloganism, Zionist groups specifically target left-wing movements, students, and youths in order to indoctrinate them into aligning with the Zionist cause. One of these groups is known as Habonim Dror. Habonim Dror is believed to have promoted the ideas of social justice and peace while running six Zionist student camps across North America. The group actively recruits young Jewish students from across the United States and Canada, though they have more minor concentrations in New Zealand, Brazil, the UK, and other countries, indoctrinating them in their camps and even including a year-long program to send them to occupied Palestine. At first glance, at their website and mission, it is clear that they are intent on separating themselves from the ruling Benjamin Netanyahu regime in Tel Aviv. Habonim Dror emphasizes the need for labor Zionism and even goes as far as suggesting ending the occupation, but ultimately succumbs to the same old two-state solution rhetoric that forces Palestinians to deal with an aggressive, genocidal, and brutal neighbor. labor Zionism, which can save you a few syllables if you just call it what it is. Zionism was a mutated appeal to the labor movement in North America. Habonim Dror was established in 1930s as an appendage faction of the mainstream Zionist movement, and it has until now taken a backseat role in picking up Jewish youth who at first were resistant to the idea of Zionism. For decades, the Israeli occupation has enjoyed total control of its image, and so its initiatives were less aggressive. Now, Habonim Dror represents a wave of Zionism meant to capture what would be dissenting Jewish voices and reprogram them to be tools for colonialism and imperialism. Its mission is designed to meet the moment of a resurgent left-wing movement in the United States, particularly after the Occupy Wall Street movement of 2011, the Bernie Sanders presidential run in 2016, and the George Floyd uprising of 2020, all three of which propelled left-wing movements and revived an interest in socialism in an otherwise deeply reactionary society. Habonim Dror may use veils like socialism and progressivism to define itself. However, its principles mention nothing of anti-imperialism and anti-colonialism. The group's socialism is a national socialism for its own fascist occupation. It is not rooted in internationalism or global worker solidarity. It is a corrupted socialism that uses sloganeering and symbolism that are aesthetic to socialism while driving a deeply reactionary and imperialist political line. Habonim Dror encourages its members, who can join as early as high school, to participate in local social justice issues, including police brutality, immigration reform, climate change, and other popular left-wing issues that have gained much attention in American society. It further trains participants to be, according to their website, leaders, changemakers, and activists in their communities, offering attractive scholarships, opportunities to travel to occupied Palestine, a rich network of connections that could offer promising careers, and formal leadership training programs. Habonim Dror seems similar to a fraternity or an innocent summer camp. However, it is adamantly dedicated to the Zionist cause, which demands the existence of Israel. It is a simple equation. Habonim Dror targets what would otherwise be neutral, uninterested, or otherwise hostile Jewish youth and codifies a left-wing Zionism in them, then encourages them to embed themselves into their communities and local movements as leaders and changemakers. They represent the face of Zionism, where Zionism would otherwise be unwelcome, and thus rebrand Zionism through a false definition. These initiatives are crafted to normalize collaboration with more hardline Zionists. By infiltrating otherwise progressive movements, labor Zionism agents can influence those around them to embrace Zionism and Israeli occupation. Zionists know that principled left-wing movements outright reject their racist ideology. In order to adapt, groups like Habonim Dror have been crafted to mutate Zionism in order to appeal to a left-wing wave that does not have strong principles of anti-imperialism and anti-colonialism. The Palestinian issue is purposely framed as complicated and sensitive in American society. Left-wing Zionists can then be deployed to command the conversation in progressive circles, rejecting any idea of a true liberation for Palestinians. As long as Zionism itself is not seen as the main issue, the Israeli occupation is framed in a positive light. A prime example of the type of influencer Habonim Dror seeks to create is the aggressively Zionist and Islamophobic actor, Sacha Baron Cohen. Cohen joined a group in his late teens in 1980s, attending summer camps and ultimately moving to the occupied Palestinian territories for a year, working alongside other Zionist youth. Later, he would play the roles of deeply racist caricatures that fueled the fire of Islamophobia at the height of post-9/11 hysteria in the United States. Cohen now spends his time as a critic of the U.S. right-wing lobby, while simultaneously spreading Zionist propaganda and continuing his racism against Muslims. He came out in fierce defense of the Israeli response to the Palestinian resistance operation Al-Aqsa Flood. Clearly, even Labour Zionism falls short of condemning the occupation, despite its insistence that it does. Habonim Dror isn't the only Zionist youth group seeking to build a generation of Zionist influencers and activists. There are many different Zionist youth groups, some that are more left-wing in nature and others that are hardline. Careful attention must be paid in order to understand how Zionists can subvert movements, organizations, and ideas, especially by weaponizing progressivism, when a progressive movement is beginning to take shape and action. Let it be clear. There is nothing progressive or left-wing about the Israeli occupation or Zionism. At its core, it will always be a racist, colonial ideology that threatens war, expansionism, and exploitation. No rebrand can ever take away these core features of Zionism.
English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to RIB English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, RIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor, Israel. Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
On the occasion of the 40th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution, February 11th, 2019, discrimination in the distribution of public resources and granting special privileges and tolerating economic cheaters, all of which result in injustice, are strictly forbidden. Moreover, ignoring classes in need of support is never acceptable. These words have been frequently repeated in the form of policies and laws, but for a proper implementation, we place our hope in the young people to do it. And if the leadership of the various sectors of the country is entrusted to young, revolutionary, wise, and competent young people, who are not few in numbers, thanks be to God, this hope will be fulfilled, God willing. National independence means the freedom of the nation and the state from the imposition and bullying of the domineering powers of the world. And social freedom means the right for every member of the society to decide, act, and think, both of which are Islamic values. They are divine gifts bestowed upon humans, and none of them is a gift to be offered to the people by the state. Governments are obliged to provide the two above-mentioned rights. The importance of freedom and independence is well known by those who have fought for it.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The Iranian nation is among them, thanks to the 40-year jihad. The current independence and freedom of the Islamic Iran were achieved by the blood of hundreds of thousands of honorable, brave, and self-sacrificing human beings, often young, but all in the high ranks of humanity. This fruit of the pure tree of the revolution cannot be put at risk by naive and sometimes biased justifications. All, especially the government of the Islamic Republic, are obligated to do their utmost to protect it. Obviously, independence should not be defined as the confinement of the politics and the economy of the country within its borders, and freedom should not be defined in opposition to divine ethics, law, values, and public rights. National dignity, foreign relations, defining border lines in relations with the enemy. The three are branches of the principle of dignity, wisdom, and expediency in international relations. The global scene today witnesses a phenomena that are unfolding or will unfold in the near future. The new dynamism of the Islamic awakening movement based on the model of resistance to the US and Zionist domination.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh Allah, I wanna thank you. That you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. I wanna thank you for bringing me home.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the World with Reporters.
Once a boomtown of the Industrial Revolution, Rochdale in northwest England has been reliably labor for years, until now. This was an election that saw allegations of fraud, desperate attempts like this one by the right-wing Reform Party.
Make sure you prevent George Galloway from being your MP for Rochdale.
And dominated by the massacre in Gaza.
From the river to the sea.
The result came hours after polls closed.
Hereby declare that George Galloway is duly elected.